Hello and welcome to the Geek Interview Podcast. I'm Jeremy Pappas, alongside, as always, a man whose dongle is at a reasonable price, Mr. Russell Jones. Russell.
Does your dongle hang low? Does it wobble to and fro? Can you tell you're not?
Yeah.
Dongle. It's just a great word that has
dongle
been added.
Dongle will never not be a good word.
This is why I like living in the future, with dongles.
This is why I like living in the future with dongles / Russell Jones.
Yep.
On the wall of history, that will be your greatest quote, something about dongles.
It's sad that I have peaked so early.
Right there, that's when Russell peaked. It's all downhill from there.
Yep.
What's going on, my friend?
Ooh, lots of stuff, actually. Very busy week, but unfortunately not as busy a week on the gaming front. Most of my games have actually kind of been held back a bit. I haven't been able to play. I have three games going on right now. I have a 13th Age game. Four games, actually. A 13th Age game with some friends down at the Gelateria.
Mm-hmm.
I have a 4th edition game with some other people that I met through a gaming group. I have a D&D Next game that I started with some people to teach them D&D and also see how they took to D&D Next as a playtest.
Mm-hmm.
And I have our Star Wars Edge of the Empire game. The Edge of the Empire game is the only one that's actually still running at the moment because the 13th Age game is on delay because one of our characters, the Paladin, moved out of town this weekend and the GM is going to some conferences. So he's unavailable. The 4th edition game is on hold because the GM and her husband drove to Canada to see family for about a week or so.
Yikes.
Right. And the D&D Next game has been on hold for a couple of weekends because of plays that have been finishing up. One of the players is the stage manager, and my wife is the house manager, so they both have to be there for the matinee performance earlier in the afternoon and the evening performance Saturday and Sunday.
Right.
So we're kind of dialed back, but it's hopefully going to ramp up in the next week or two. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, on the news front as well, it's been just a little slow. I think everyone kind of got to a point where after Comic-Con, it was like, okay, well, now let's take a break.
Yep.
No more new things.
We are hitting famine after the feast.
Yes. So welcome to famine. But we still have some things to talk about. As I mentioned beforehand, the making a lot of waves right now is Google's Chromecast. Now, Chromecast is a dongle that attaches to your TV in two different ways and allows you essentially to stream things to your TV. Now, it's the crazy thing about it. It's a pretty standard deal as far as what it can do. It can't do as much as a Roku or as an Apple TV, but it is sort of getting there.
Yeah, it's kind of weird how it does it. Here's what the Chromecast does. It's $35. You've got this thing that looks about the size of a USB drive, and you plug it into, if you have a USB port on your television, you can plug it in there, or you plug it into the HDMI port, and so it's flexible. Because dongle jokes, why not?
You're right.
The thing is that it'll stream apps that are prepared for Chromecast, so Netflix is one specifically. When you buy it, I think it comes with 3 months of Netflix for free.
Right.
So you can tell it to queue up on your Chromecast from any device that has Netflix on it, and it'll play on the thing. That's kind of where it's different from other devices that have dedicated apps on them, such as Apple TV or Roku. And the other thing that it does that's really interesting is that it will mirror anything that you can put in a Chrome browser on any device that has a Chrome browser.
As I've been reading, it apparently doesn't work as seamlessly as that.
That's the pitch, though.
Yeah, the pitch is that you'll be able to throw anything into your Chrome browser and mirror it on your TV. According to the CNET review that I've read, and I trust CNET, they've never really steered me wrong,
right.
It doesn't quite work as well to that. They even go as far as saying it's largely limited to the four apps that you start off with. which does not include Amazon Instant Prime, HBO Go, MLB TV, Spotify, RDO, stuff like that. So I think the most important thing here is that this thing costs $35 freaking.
Yeah, that's a big, big deal.
That's crazy. Because the closest, I mean, you can get a Roku for $50.
Yeah.
Which is still significantly more. But Roku can't stream, I mean, once they get the mirroring feature working, you'll be, I hate using the term killer app, but that's crazy. That's like somebody coming out with a car that retails for $2,500.
Yeah, because, I mean, let's look at the other device that really does the same thing from the mirroring front, and that's the Apple TV.
Right.
Apple TV is $100. It requires, you know, the HDMI port to plug in, and then it'll run dedicated apps on it, and there's quite a few beyond just, you know, like the big four, like Netflix or Hulu. The other thing that Apple TV does is that it has direct access to your iTunes account and your iTunes media. So that's a pretty big deal if you have
if you're an iTunes person.
Right. And it'll mirror anything on an Apple device from AirPlay. So if you have an iPad, your laptop, or an iPhone, it will mirror that stuff. But as compared to that, Chrome's pitch essentially makes Apple TV look overpriced and complicated, at least from the initial blush, which I think is, I mean, this is bigger for two things. It's good for Google because this is, you know, they're trying to compete with Apple on the television front, and there's been that kind of talk about that for a while, and this is one of the ways they're doing it, and I think it's actually a pretty cool way, especially for all those people that are not, you know, you don't feel tied to Apple anymore if you want to be able to do this thing. The other side of it, though, is that with such a massively low price point, it means that more and more people are going to start trying streaming stuff, ideally, and that could lead to more cable cutting, a greater amount of people, you know, changing the way that the overall market watches television. And the more that that market share cuts into, you know, the cable cutting share cuts into overall media, the more likely we are to see changes from other media to compensate as a result.
Right.
So it's, I would say, another pretty big shot being fired in the cable cutters war. But for Chrome, it may not necessarily dominate on the front, but it's certainly going to find a place for a whole lot of people that, you know, would not have bought in for, you know, $100 Apple TV.
Right. I mean, I really think that once they get all of the bugs worked out, and it sounds like that's what they're working on, once they get all the bugs worked out and it works the way they say it can work, that it'll be the new thing. It'll be the thing that everyone gets, plugs into their TV, and it'll be the first, let me put it this way. It'll be the first Apple TV Roku-like device that your mom will have.
I say that that's very likely.
Which is good for the reasons you mentioned. I mean, and you kind of have to tie this back to Netflix to a certain extent. It will make something like Netflix even more ubiquitous than it's already starting to become, which means, I mean, and Netflix is not, you know, they're not playing games. They're really doing what they're doing. I mean, making it happen. They're their own shows. They're doing everything they can possibly do to fight their edge of, or their side of the cable cutters war. And they're not doing so bad. I mean, they've got original series that are really seriously popular. They're grabbing a bunch of other things. The only issue they have is distribution. And something like Chromecast comes out and really, I mean, amps up the volume. Now, again, they still have a little way to go.
Yeah.
The $35 price point is crazy.
Yeah.
This is Chromecast 1. So in 2 years, when we have Chromecast 4 and all of these bugs are worked out.
2 years? Heck, I'd say something like, you know, a year or less.
I guess we will see.
Well, because think about it. It's a little tiny dongle.
Uh-huh.
You know, how much iteration do they have to do to be able to push another version of it on the market? I mean, you could do, you know, software updates all day for something like Roku or Apple TV, but if you have to do a major hardware change to it, that's a pretty significant deal in the sheer amount, at the same time.
I have a Roku. You can get a Roku for $50, which is only 15 more than Chromecast. And Roku has a lot that Chromecast doesn't. Now, it can't do everything that Chromecast can do, but it can do a lot of things that Chromecast can do. And it has a remote. Let's not forget it has a fucking remote. That's not a dedicated tablet, which is what the... Or it's not a dedicated tablet-like device like the Chromecast uses. It has an app on one of your tablet that you can use to push the buttons like a remote.
Right.
The Roku's little box comes with a remote where it's just like a VCR. You push the buttons, you're good to go. And it's $50. So if they're going to try and make people buy Chromecast 2 and it's another $35, you're already paying more than you would for a Roku. And you can update your Roku, as I have only had to do once or twice.
Right.
So they're going to have to come up with, you know, that's why I think it could take them a little bit more time to really figure out how it's supposed to work and make it work the way that they want it to work. But they have a lot going for them. And if I were Apple, I would not be surprised to see Apple coming out with something like Apple TV Mini that was like $50, $60.
Yes.
That tries to do a lot of the same thing that Chromecast does, but less than what Apple TV does. Or less than what Apple TV 2 does whenever that comes out.
Right. I think that Apple has the chance to do the same thing if they just did the mirroring. If they could make a tiny device like that that does mirroring for all of their stuff, then you could do that.
Well, I mean, Google is already ahead because, and I don't mean this negatively, but there are many people out there that do not. I mean, if you gave me an Apple TV, it'd be completely useless.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people that are like that. I don't have iTunes anywhere. I don't own anything via iTunes. You know, Apple TV has a smaller market to sell to than does Google. Chromecast can go to anybody because anyone can for free download the Chrome browser. Hell, most people are already using it, or a good portion of people are already using it. Not most.
Yep.
That would be Firefox. So Google is hitting Apple where they're most vulnerable, which is their complete inability and unwillingness to free up their devices.
Yeah.
I mean, Google allows you to do whatever you want. Apple, you're very regimented. Now, if you're already an Apple customer and you're already on that Apple roller coaster, which is a lot of fun, it has a lot of highs, it's really fast. It's probably one of the better roller coasters around, but if you're on the Apple roller coaster, you don't ever get off. You're on it forever, which, again, is perfectly fine. But with something like Google Chrome, they're saying, hey, all those people out there who have Samsung phones, all those people out there who have Android phones, why not maybe make Chromecast your thing? So Apple's got to do some moving and shaking to make this happen. Now, something like Roku, on the other hand, they're going to have to figure out a way to compete with Roku because it's a lot more popular than people give it credit for.
Yeah.
It's really super easy to use, and it can do, with the exception of the streaming through a browser, it can do everything that Chromecast can do and will likely be able to do, you know, moving forward.
Here's the other side of what Chromecast does that I think is important. It can be seen as possibly the gateway drug into streaming.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because,
like I said,
it's $35.
It's the streaming device that your parents will have.
Exactly. But they buy this, you know, they buy this and they start using it, and maybe they use it for a year or so, and then they think, you know, we're using this thing. We've changed our habits quite a bit because it's so much easier.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, here's this other device that's only $50 that does a bit more. And they upgrade their Chromecast to a Roku, or they upgrade to an Apple TV, or, you know, something along those lines. It's entirely possible that if you don't, you know, get people that are stuck just in the Chromecast side of things,
right,
that they decide to branch out into, you know, the streaming world a little bit longer, which means that there is more. Chromecast, if it takes off the way that we think it's going to because of its price point and because of its features, it could help broaden the market even further for more streaming devices beyond just the three that we've got, the Roku, the Apple TV, and the Chromecast. We're not really including like video game consoles, because that's an entirely different thing altogether.
Yeah, and a video game console's 10 times the cost of a Chromecast, so.
Exactly. And it's, people aren't buying a video game console to be a streaming device.
Right. You hear that, Microsoft?
God damn it. Yes, we like the fact that there may be some additional stuff to it. Not the freaking point.
Dogs, TV, TV, dogs, dogs. Did I mention dogs? TV, TV. Yeah. I think about Chromecast this way. With 3 months of free Netflix, your Chromecast costs you $10. So, I mean, it's got a lot of promise. It's got a lot of developers are going to be able to make their own apps for it. So, I mean, as Chromecast gets bigger, you'll start seeing stuff like HBO Go and Spotify will all pop up on Chromecast. Chromecast. I wouldn't even have
Chromecast. That's what Conan streams stuff on. What is on? Steel. All day.
I will watch Dancing with the Stars. I'm surprised Schwarzenegger hasn't shown up on Dancing with the Stars.
You would think by now.
You'd think so. He's an old man, though.
Oof.
So, anyway, Chromecast is, it's looking pretty cool. I would say go out and pick one up, but you can't because they're sold out for weeks. But if you get
Amazon has had them kind of in and out.
You can go and throw your $35 down and wait patiently by your mailbox. You may get one in 3 weeks or a month. I have a Roku. If it gets to a point where I'm looking like I might want to upgrade my Roku to something else, maybe I go to a Chromecast. Even if I go with a Chromecast and don't like it, I go just buy another Roku. I'm out $35. That's the great place to be. That's the great place to be as far as devices are concerned. When it's cheap enough that you can go, I'll give it a shot.
Yep.
If I don't like it, then I wasted $35. But at least I know.
Yep.
You know, at least I know that is the case.
$35, I would argue, is also a very easy Christmas present for, like you said, parents.
It is a very sibling easy Christmas present. It is easy for someone to ask for a Chromecast. Just say, hey, this is what I would like for Christmas. Because you know how Christmas works. You have people that are going to spend a lot of money on you and people that are not going to spend as much money on you.
So, or you've got set limits and that fits.
Right, so you can ask a second-tier gift giver to give you a Chromecast. And at first, you can save your cameras and whatever to a first-tier gift giver.
An alpha gift giver.
Yes, an alpha gift giver as opposed to a beta gift giver.
Right.
So I definitely believe we'll see a lot more from Chromecast very soon. As soon as they start rolling out, TV ads, as soon as they start rolling out TV, it'll really take off. I feel like this is the thing that your news stations will start grabbing onto and calling new. Even though streaming TV has been around forever, you'll really start. You can stream your internet on your TV so easily the way that works.
Yeah.
I really feel like you'll start seeing that a lot more. I guess we'll see. If you have a Chromecast, shoot. I'd like to get some insider information because I'm just reading the CNET review and I trust CNET.
Yeah.
But you know. Maybe they're not entirely on the money. So if you disagree, tweet at us or shoot us an email. Let us know, and we can discuss that as we're going forward with this whole process. But I will definitely be keeping my ear to the ground as far as Chromecast is concerned. Because, yep. I mean...
Now, I would also point out, shout out to a good friend of mine, Jason Evangelo. He's a tech writer over at Forbes.com.
Mm-hmm.
He got a Chromecast for their office and is writing about that and kind of checking that out. So there's another source you can go looking for stuff. And that is a guy, straight stand-up guy, really, really solid, good stuff. If you're also interested in gaming PCs and building your own gaming PCs, he has massive amounts of resources. Mm-hmm. So yeah, check those out for as well. It is something that... Even though we don't necessarily need it, it's not necessarily for us because we already have this stuff. We were early adopters.
Right.
This is something that we are eagerly watching because it could have further implications, mm-hmm. for the entirety of the cable cutters, you know, market.
Right. And I mean, I still even have cable. I just supplement it with the old Roku.
Right, which I don't because I enjoy I enjoy paying, you know, less than half the price that I paid for cable just to have internet, and then I supplement that with the Netflix subscriptions and Hulu subscriptions and Amazon Prime.
Which is how you should work things. So we've been it was a little bit of a challenge to find things to talk about outside of Chromecast for today, but luckily there are a lot of RPG Kickstarters that are kicking around.
Yep.
So we're kind of going to give you a rundown of some of the big projects that are out there right now, starting with a game by Brian James and Matt James, who you will likely know from Loremaster, called Red Aegis. And it is it's a tabletop role-playing game that is, I would say, different than any other tabletop role-playing game you will have played. It's kind of its own thing.
Yeah, it's pretty unconventional. The real interesting thing about that, kind of the first hook that you get set in, is that you know how in a lot of current RPGs, the standard model is you get a character, you play that character, and you play it over the course of a story or a campaign or something, over the course of multiple sessions. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we start over either when that character dies, which is sad, or whenever you start a new game or a new campaign, you pick a new character, and you're kind of tied into that one character. Uh-huh. In Red Aegis, it kind of throws that out the window by expanding the timeline significantly. Mm-hmm. Instead of playing one character, the pitch is that you play multiple characters all within the same lineage of each other. So you have, a barbarian who then begats a king, who then begats a shadowy ranger, who then begats a wizard, who then begats blah, 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 blah. But it goes even further than that, all the way up to, they mention space marines packing gravity hammers. So every session, you play a brand new character who is a descendant of your previous session's character, which I think is pretty cool. And as you play over the course of a campaign, you will see the world evolve, you know, from this medieval or ancient world all the way to a modern or a futuristic world. They mentioned that it's inspired by games like Sid Meier's Civilization, which I've actually been playing Civ 5 all weekend, and I would absolutely – that's the first thing that I thought of as well. Because you can see, like, I've been playing the Iroquois this weekend, and having the Iroquois armed regiments and the Thunder Brigade artillery squads rolling around is just awesome. So, you know, that kind of thing being translated into a tabletop setting – you know, focusing specifically on characters, I think sounds really cool. And enough people have found it cool as well that they are currently funded with 26 days left to go. So if you put money in at this point, then the project will be going forward. Mm-hmm. Note that I did not say you'll get your book, but we're going to talk about that more a little bit later.
Right. Not that we're saying you won't get your book.
No, these guys are stand-up guys. They have a solid idea, and they've got very good planning behind it. There's no reason to doubt that you won't get an awesome game and a really awesome gaming experience from it. So at this point, you're in it for the backer rewards and the stretch goals. So Red Aegis by Vorpal Games. It seems really cool. It's a concept that I'm really interested in, especially since, you know, I will admit that sometimes you get into a game and you get into a setting – and you play for a couple sessions, and then something catches your eye, and you kind of jones for something else, you know? Mm-hmm. So this gives you the opportunity to get a very broad sample, kind of the buffet of campaign settings and timelines and things like that, while still remaining dedicated and invested in a single story.
Right. I mean, the concept sounds really cool. It's something I would definitely be interested in trying out. My only concern is how your kind of character creation, not character creation, but you usually have to spend some time with a character, and having sort of Dixie Cup characters you throw away after every session, I'm sure they know what they're doing enough to make that fit and work really well, maybe into sort of like a common character model that then takes on other, but it definitely is... It's extremely ambitious. I'm really looking forward to see what they put out once they put it out, now that it's funded. Now, we mentioned a little bit about some issues people are having with Kickstarter. Some, what would you call it?
I would say fiascos.
Yeah. Or
Boondoggle. Boondoggle fits really well, I think.
You likely remember the Zach Braff flack. He tried to kickstart a movie, I want to say. And he's a multimillionaire. I mean, people say it goes against the spirit of Kickstarter. Be that as it... I mean, if you feel that's the case, then that is your... that's your point of view. I tend to think, yeah, it sort of is. Because every dollar that a Zach Braff type gets, or I think, Russell, you mentioned Spike Jonze was trying to kickstart a movie.
I believe so. There was basically another multimillion-dollar celebrity was trying to kickstart something, and they got flack for it because people were like, you have money. Why are you coming to us asking for money?
Right.
And a lot of it has to do with, you know, the idea that Kickstarter is a place where primarily creators can go to free themselves from, you could argue, the tyranny of the publisher, who has, you know, money that they would be then risking to publish the material the creator creates. And because they have that, you know, kind of cash cudgel to wage over their head, they can maybe wield a bit of influence over that. And this essentially goes straight to the people who would be consuming it and cuts out that middleman. That's kind of the idea, especially for people that have been watching video game fundings. However, that's not always what happens, and bad things have been happening recently in areas where that's not the point.
Well, let me jump in and say we need to correct. It's not Spike Jonze, it's Spike Lee.
Spike Lee.
Two completely different people.
Yes.
Spike Lee is on Kickstarter to ask for funding for a movie that he's interested in making. I'm trying to find the name of it. I believe it's about a barber shop. So it's Spike Lee, not Spike Jonze. I'm sure Macy's yelling at the podcast right now, listening to it later on, because that's what she does when Russell messes something up. The same thing sort of happened with Zach Braff. He tried to kickstart something, and everyone's like, "Hey, Zach Braff, you're super rich. Why are you doing this?" And he raised, you know, $3 million for his for his film. Which is money that could have gone to smaller, you know, so what Kickstarter is intended for. Kickstarter is intended to allow people who don't have a ton of capital get the capital from people that are invested in the money. It's basically like, instead of the old model, which is a company has a lot of money just from having a previous success or investments, they invest that in a thing, that thing comes out, and then that company is repaid by the people who like that thing. The way Kickstarter works, and this is obvious to everybody, but I feel like I need to go to sort of go through it, is the person has the idea for the thing, people go, "Oh, I like that idea," and give the person money to make the thing. It's shorter, and it makes a lot of sense. Now, when you're dealing with somebody who has a lot of money, they're basically saying, "Hey, this is the way people complain. This is what they say." And I think it's got a lot of merit. "Hey, Zach Braff, you could easily fund this yourself. You're just trying to make extra money out of your project." Because people who don't have the money to fund their Kickstarters don't make any extra money from the Kickstarter. They make as much as they would have made before through, because people who fund your Kickstarter are interested in your product and are many times getting something out of it. So with somebody like Zach Braff, he could very easily spend the $3 million, make his pet project and put it out there and get paid back. He's wanting people to give him $3 million so he can make his pet project and then for them to give him more money later on down the line. So it leaves a bad taste in people's mouths.
Right.
I totally understand that.
The flip side of the argument I would say is that in some of these cases, projects wind up costing more than even they raise above their initial amount because they start to get ambitious. Let's take a look at Double Fine. They had their adventure game that raised a lot of money on Kickstarter, well over its goal.
Mm.
And then after development came back and said, well, we got a bit ambitious. It's you know, taken up the money and then some. We are going to try to do a kind of two separate releases and get the game to you as quickly as we can. But the short answer is that it took a lot more money than we expected to make this thing. So it's entirely possible that, you know, not only would someone like Zach Braff, who puts this thing up and says, hey, we need, you know, $1.5 million to make this game. It's not necessarily that he couldn't put up $1.5 million itself. It's possible that this project might take $4 million or $5 million. And $1.5 million is the seed money that he plans to put up his own money as well. But all of that is stuff that should be explained.
It should be
by
obvious.
The project. Exactly.
It should be obvious.
Right. So let's talk about a real cautionary tale, because there is the flip side of, okay, let's say you do give someone your money, then nothing happens. What happens then? Which has happened in a couple of cases, but this week happened to someone that we hold near and dear to our hearts, and a couple of people do as well. Keith Baker, who is known for making the Eberron setting, as well as a very fun card game called Gloom, has been working on a board game with a friend of his for a while now called The Doom That Came to Atlantic City. The people who were going to publish that is from a company called The Forked Path. And they raised money on Kickstarter for this board game. They raised about $122,000 plus, and they were only asking like $35,000. Mm. So they raised their money and then some.
However, I would say probably from the reason they raised their money so quickly is because Keith Baker and Lee Moyer are their commodities. They're well known. And
exactly.
And people can look at it and go, I would buy anything that has Keith Baker's name on it that I see. I'll go ahead and do that now.
Yeah. And the game itself, The Doom That Came to Atlantic City, had kind of a lot of elements that people were really interested in because it was a Cthulhu-esque look at Monopoly, essentially. And if you look at the art for this thing, the pieces that they were showing off, which were, you know, Elder Gods, just
it's beautiful.
Really good stuff. Uh-huh. And yeah, so they raised a lot of money. Then, on July 23rd, the project creator Eric Chevalier wrote that the project is over and the game has been canceled.
Mm-hmm.
He said that every possible mistake was made, some due to his inexperience in board game publishing, others due to conflicts, legal issues, and technical complications.
Mm-hmm.
So, essentially, he's saying there's not going to be a game, and the money is not there, which is not good at all.
Right.
Especially because he's not exactly the creator. He's the publisher. Well, the creators were Keith Baker and Lee Moyer, and Keith Baker posted a big blog post because he was absolutely in the dark that there were problems, and he's been trying to get this board game made for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
So he put out a big post that's made its way around to a lot of different blogs, showing things from his side of the fence and kind of giving people an insight into the problems that, you know, creators can sometimes run into. So here we have an issue where not only did the creator not do this Kickstarter, the publisher essentially did this Kickstarter, then they screwed the whole thing up. And there's nothing to show for the money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there could be legal issues because, as is noted on a couple of places, Kickstarter, as part of their requirements, require the person to say, if you do this and you make your funding, you are legally obligated to turn something out for it.
Right. But you have to give backers what you have agreed to give them.
Right. But after that funding is met, Kickstarter kind of steps back from any responsibility whatsoever. And so, as a result, the backers have absolutely every right to legally go after the person who took their money.
Right.
But how many of them are going to be able to, A, have the wherewithal to do so, B, have the funding to do so, and C, have the clout to maybe get everyone together and actually make something happen?
So when do you think they will start a Kickstarter to sue another Kickstarter?
The guy.
I'm surprised that hasn't already happened. That's exactly what I would do.
I would bet it's an Indiegogo. Not a Kickstarter, but...
Right, but yeah, crowdfunding their lawsuit.
I would absolutely not be shocked. I would not be shocked if this thing went on.
I mean, if you can contact all the people who who put their money in and said, hey, put some more money and you can get your money back, would maybe not be a terrible idea.
Yeah.
So, you know,
so anyway,
that is what it is.
The two people who are actually putting pressure on this that should be and will probably get something done are Keith and Lee. So
here's hoping. From what I've read now, as I've sort of looked over these articles, it apparently this guy who did Forked Path game or who was doing Forked Path, he apparently quit his job to do this. Some pretty popular theories that are going around FARC and Reddit and other news aggregator type sites are that they were having problems because it was so similar to Monopoly. They were having some legal issues and things like that. So,
which is interesting considering that Monopoly has been this kind of, I would argue, a little bit more of an open brand because you have almost every kind of opoly that exists out there, including the make-your-own-opoly, you know what I mean? So I would think that that's entirely possible, but either way, it's just bad. Uh-huh. And it is the absolute caveat emptor for people that get involved in Kickstarter. And partly that fear is the prime reason why I still have not Kickstartered anything. Uh-huh. I'll buy it when it comes out, and I'm happy to see people supporting it. I just don't have the money to risk, which is the thing that a lot of publishers, you know, the people, and I've said since the beginning of Kickstarter, the people who are putting their money up are now getting a better taste and understanding of what it's like to be a publisher, mm-hmm. someone who actually has that money to invest. And, you know, it's not always going to be bread and tulips.
Nope. You are an investor when you plunk down money for a Kickstarter. People are used to going online and buying things. You're not buying things. You're investing in something.
Exactly. You're betting the money.
It is something to... Now, 99% of Kickstarters, you're not going to have these... Well, maybe not 99%. Most Kickstarters, you're not going to have these issues. If you really do your research, make sure that who you're giving the money to is someone who's capable of producing the product, then, you know, you're usually okay. In this, it seems like something that this Eric Chevalier guy just... totally fucked up, and I'm not gonna call him names because I don't know him or really know as much about it enough to call him names, but
it's entirely possible that this was absolutely well intentioned and that absolutely you know, the thing is that especially if this is your first time doing something like this, entrepreneurial images are really hard to do. Like,
there's a reason most of them fail. Yeah,
exactly. And that's the kind of stuff you need to look for if you decide to put your money down, especially a lot of money. If it's an established company that's put out plenty of product, then, you know, that's one thing. But if it's a guy that you do some searching and you're like, has he done anything before now? You know, you can't just be fry throwing your money at a screen.
Right. Be smart when you're doing these. But, I mean, there are wins out of Kickstarter.
Absolutely.
For instance, Shadowrun is a throwback game that they funded through Kickstarter.
Yep. Shadowrun Returns, now out this week.
$2 million raised on Kickstarter. I'll post some links on the podcast page if you're interested. Looks really good. Looks Shadowrun-y, and I have never really been a big Shadowrun guy. Growing up, a friend of mine was hard into Shadowrun, so I know enough about it to be dangerous.
Yeah, I have a friend who is a really big time Shadowrunner who runs like games at conventions and contributes to source books. And I actually bought back when I was in college, they did a Shadowrun Bigatures game, which was, instead of, you know, like HeroClix minis, instead of that, you had an action figure sized thing. And I really wish I hadn't gotten rid of them because they were just badass to look at. And it had a base that had all the kind of stuff you would find on a MechWarrior or a HeroClix thing, like damage and health and things like that. And it also had a ton of little props and things inside its base that you could then attach to your character for its build, like fireballs or automatic weapons or, you know, hacking tools and things like that. And you played with this one Shadowrunner that was this big miniature against other people that had it. No one else bought the game. I had, like, four of the miniatures.
Yeah, so Russell had all of the miniatures. He could only play by himself.
Right, but it was a cool concept. And so, you know, Shadowrun is one of those really evocative settings. And I'm glad to see that this game not only got funded, but also is out now and is getting a lot of attention. It's actually doing, from what I say, quite well in the reviews. I'm hoping to get a chance to review it. If not, then I'll probably just plunk down the $20 that it's going to take to buy it.
Thank you.
The real interesting thing about Shadowrun that I've seen from the reviews is not so much that it is, you know, just an isometric RPG set in this world. It's that it also comes with an extremely robust set of tools, a la Neverwinter Nights, to make your own games. Mm-hmm. So once you play through the campaign that's included, you can go play through other people's games, which is an even greater throwback to the pen and paper games of old, you know, when Shadowrun first came out. And just, it looks really slick. It's got a lot of great art to it. You know, the people who were originally involved with starting Shadowrun and writing the first novels and things, they are the ones who were behind this project. So this is the kind of thing where, you know, the creators are involved from the beginning, and it's just, it's turned out really well. So that's a very good example of a Kickstarter success story. And especially on the video game front, it feels like there just haven't been a ton of them that have drawn a lot of attention.
No, and you know? People, you said before, it's something that it really gives players an idea of what publishers go through and how long these things take to do. I mean, this isn't something, you know, again, you're not buying something, you're investing. And investing, you put your money down in hopes of getting something later. That's what investing is. So, you know, you kind of have to get out of that mindset if you want to be a Kickstarter backer. Now, there are some exceptions to that rule. The minis we were talking about a while ago, they were going to make the minis. They were just going to, you know, they needed the money to pay the people to make them. So if you were essentially buying minis you were almost certain you were going to get.
Yep.
I mean, one thing that people who run Kickstarters that are successful can do to keep people happy is to provide updates. And Kickstarter allows that on their Kickstarter page, which is really good because it gives people, because once you go to a page and you put your money in that page, then, you know, it's something that you're kind of on that page now, you know, you're going to want to go back to it and check things out. So if you have developers who are really open about what's going on, who are really, really transparent with everything they're doing, I think you're going to avoid a lot of the problems that you've had with, you know, the doom that came to Atlantic City and things like that.
It's just, you know, do your research beyond the shiny front page, basically.
Speaking of giving those updates, you may recall we did an interview with David Hill from Apotheosis Drive X, which I've still not been able to figure out how to say. They have been doing regular updates. Very regular updates.
Like he's got a full page view just from this week alone.
Yeah. And they're giving, hey, this is what this is looking like. And we actually have now a cover, or what I believe is a cover, that looks really cool. I'll link it in the podcast page to go check it out. If you backed them, go and read and see what they're doing. I mean, they're talking about a ton of stuff. They link you to Google Docs and you can take a look at everything that's going on. People are commenting on the posts. So they've sort of turned it into a community all around Apotheosis Drive X. Yes. Said it right that time.
There you go.
They've created a community, which makes a lot of sense because you all have something in common. You know, you go to communities with people you have in common. You all have something in common. You're all interested in this one game. So instead of saying, well, go to apotheosisdrivex.com and blah, 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 they just put it on Kickstarter. And they have 11 pages of updates they've done since the Kickstarter was kickstarted.
And funded back in April.
Yes. So pretty good.
This is exactly the kind of example I was talking about earlier. This is creator-driven, you know, being able to bring out something that you wouldn't be able to just because you don't have the money to do it.
Right.
And you can tell, I mean, just talking with David, he really is passionate about this.
Mm.
And the amount of effort and work that's being put into it shows that this is going to be a really good product. And that's... Those are the kind of things that you want to see. You want to see...
Those are the kind of people you want to have quadruple the amount of money they ask for.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what happened. $5,000 goal raised $21,603.
Yeah. It could be the first Fate-powered game that I actually get a chance to try.
I would say that's likely the case. If you plan on trying it. And I would like to. So we're reaching sort of the end of the podcast, but I wanted to talk about something that I noticed that sort of made me laugh and shake my head. And to talk about just people just not getting it. So there's a new Super Smash Brothers game coming out for Wii U. That never gets old.
It really doesn't.
If you played Super Smash Bros. Brawl, you might remember a subspace emissary adventure mode where you got cutscenes featuring all of the characters in Smash Bros. It makes sense. I mean, who wouldn't go see a movie that included Donkey Kong and Wario and Metroid and Pikachu and Link and Mario and Peach and Solid
Wii
Snake?
Wii Fit Trainer.
Well, that's for the coming up Smash Brothers. Who wouldn't want to go watch a movie like that, right? I mean, who wouldn't? I'd do it just to say, well, so Donkey Kong and Samus are going to be in the same, really?
So what you're saying is that you're going to go watch the Lego movie.
Well, yeah, maybe. I like the Lego movie. I think the Lego movie looks good. But, so, when they did Super Smash Bros. Brawl, they created this subspace emissary adventure mode, which allowed them to do just that, putting all the characters together. I mean, when you have license to use the characters, they all have voice actors. They have, you can animate them because you have animators. Why wouldn't you spend the money to put together even a cool short story mode, right? I mean, it's a no-brainer. Okay. Well, the next Super Smash Brothers that's coming out, which I don't think it has a name yet. I think it's just Super Smash Brothers for Wii U. It's also going to be on the 3DS. One of the creator behind Super Smash Brothers, Masahiro Sakurai, has said he will not have this adventure mode cutscene thing again. So you're probably thinking, oh, maybe there was some legal issues, and maybe the Pokemon didn't want their Pokemans to be in with Link. Maybe there's some. No, the reason is this. Now, I hope you're sitting down because this may be the dumbest thing I've ever said. Masahiro Sakurai specifically saw that somebody had taken the cutscenes and put them on YouTube. Doi. Of course they did. That's what YouTube is for. He said, I'm just going to quote him from this article that I'm getting on Kotaku, that I will link on the podcast page if you want to read it. Unfortunately, the movie scenes we worked hard to create were uploaded onto the internet. Okay, you worked hard to create them, but the game was out. They weren't leaked, you know. Anyway. You can only truly wow a player the first time he sees a cutscene. I felt if players saw the cutscenes outside the game, they would no longer serve as rewards for playing the game. So I've decided against having them. What?
It's that right there. It is that right.
What the fuck? Okay, first of all, let's break this down. You can only truly wow a player the first time he sees a cutscene. Okay, granted.
I would argue that point as a person who has watched, continues to watch, and occasionally just pines for and watches again all three of the. All three of the cinematics for Star Wars: The Old Republic. Mm. I don't think that's true.
Well,
because I still watch them, and I'm just like, oh.
Let's say that it is true. Some people obviously can watch it over and over again, but you're it's like seeing a movie and you know what's going to happen, so you sort of lose that. It's like people say, I wish that I could forget that all this happened so I could turn around and watch it again and have that first experience. Okay, let's agree that that is true. Upon the second viewing, it loses something. So the first time is really important. Let's assume that's true. And what's are you going to take your game and rig it to where when somebody finally beats the game, it explodes? Because your game is going to, I mean, they're going to, if they're going to play through the adventure mode again, it's going to, that makes no, who cares? People are still seeing it, right? Then he says, I felt if players saw the cutscene outside the game, they would no longer serve as rewards for playing the game. Is it a reward? It's part of the game.
The whole point of playing the game is not to watch the cutscenes. The point of playing the game is that I can take Link and absolutely murder Kirby constantly.
I screw
that little pink puffball.
I appreciate what the guy is saying to an extent. It's a reward that they worked hard to put together and they didn't want it spoiled. Okay. You don't get to choose that. The internet exists. It's gonna happen. In fact, Masahiro Sakurai, who I'm certain listens to our podcast, as soon as I finish recording, I don't have a Wii, and I've played Super Smash Bros. Brawl, but I don't have a Wii, so I didn't realize there was a Subspace Emissary Adventure Mode. I'm gonna go on YouTube and watch Subspace Emissary Adventure Mode on YouTube because I'm interested to see. The fact that he's just not doing it makes no sense. It just doesn't make sense. It's like saying, well, I'm not going to make dessert because you might eat it before dinner. But then when dinner's over, there's no dessert. You can't not have it so it doesn't happen before because then it can't happen later, which is the whole goddamn point.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to mean the game doesn't sell because, like I said...
No. This is just something that I found to be ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
The game is still going to do really well. It's going to be a great... And I'm sure... I'm sure it's going to be a great game. You know what would make it even greater? If fucking Kirby had a conversation with the Wii Fit Trainer. If Mega Man got into an argument with Wario. I would fucking dig that. That would be awesome. But they're just sort of like, meh... We just won't do that. Why? Create something that's cool. Allow the people who do experience it in that pure way, who play the adventure scene and they're blah, 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 and they kill and they finish their match and the cutscene comes up and it's perfect. It's exactly what, and they get create it for those people, knowing that not everyone's going to have that experience. I mean, have you ever gone and watched a movie that the ending was ruined for you after beforehand?
Insomniac was ruined for me in a review, but I finally watched it at some point.
But you watched it. I'm sure you still enjoyed it if you enjoyed the movie.
Not Insomniac. Memento? With, yep.
Memento?
Memento. Ending for Memento was ruined. And in a review. And then I got a chance to actually watch it. Memento, especially having the ending ruined for you did not necessarily, you know, remove the experience of that whole fucked up film.
Mm.
But yeah.
But you still saw it.
Yeah, I still watched it.
You still, I assume, felt the way about it you would have felt about it regardless.
Here's a better example. Star Wars The Force Unleashed.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a crappy game, but it was, you know, in the Star Wars universe, so Star Wars, you know, Star Wars. Because Star Wars. And I'm a massive Star Wars fan, so I'd heard about, oh, the story is supposed to bridge the blah, 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 to do this and that, and I thought, you know what, I'm just gonna... Fine. So I went to YouTube, and bless their soul, someone loaded all the cutscenes from The Force Unleashed online. And I got to watch them all, and I got, okay... This is what the story of the game is. I eventually bought the game when it was like $5.
Mm.
Because at that point, that's the value that I got out of the game. I could see if you have a crappy game, like an absolute piece of one-star crap game that you're charging $60 for. But the prime reason that people are going to buy this game is because of the story that's in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Then I can see how you as a creator would not want your one bullet in your gun to get flung out all over the internet.
Right.
But that's not what you have here. You have Super Smash Brothers, and the whole point is to smash people.
Right.
The cutscenes are the dessert, exactly.
It's like sprinkles on top of your cupcake.
Right. So if anything, having those in the game and then having some of those cutscenes put online out of the context of the game would drive more sales because people would watch them and go, oh, wow, I need to get that game, and they would buy the game. That's essentially what you're doing, is you are hurting the chances of people buying your game. But this, unfortunately, follows along with what Nintendo has been kind of on a tear about recently, which is removing stuff from YouTube because they've been fighting Let's Play videos that have Nintendo properties in them. It's just... it's kind of a weird thing that I have unfortunately seen on the news side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, someone gets a bug up their ass and they suddenly were like, well, we need to go on and tell all these people on YouTube to take down the videos that have any of our content in it because it's not their content. Murdy, hurdy, murdy, murdy.
So, right, not realizing that if you can, especially content that you've gotten all of the use out of that you're going to get, let it continue to bring people in. Let it keep working for you. If I write a song and I record it and I sell it and it sells well and I create a music video and the music video does what the music video is supposed to do, and I have stopped really getting a ton of royalties from people downloading the song or watching the music video. This isn't a perfect analogy. Stay with me. If somebody uploads the video, if somebody uploads the song to a site like YouTube, I don't feel the need to go and say, hey, remove my song from YouTube. And it gets people to listen to it. And if they dig it, maybe they'll come and buy it from my store. Maybe they'll come to one of my concerts. You know, it's something like that. I listen to a lot of music on YouTube. You could agree. You could make an argument that YouTube doesn't have the right, nor do these people who create these YouTube music videos, which is usually just a picture of the artist and the song, because you just want to listen to the music. You could agree, and they have the ability to come in and go, hey, take that down. And sometimes they do. But a lot of the times they don't. So I can get on and listen to somebody's Led Zeppelin playlist and chill out. You don't see, I hope, Zeppelin coming out and going, eh, you should probably spend all this money to blah, 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 blah. When it's just like, hey, you know what? These songs were recorded in the 60s and 70s. You've gotten all the use out of them you're going to get. I'm a fan. Just let it keep working for you, man. Let it keep. Don't try and fight it. It's like people who stay in hurricane, you know, targeted areas with the hurricane coming. It's like just get out of the way, dude, because it's gonna end really poorly for you. You know, it's one of those sort of deals. When are people going to understand the internet?
Unfortunately, probably when it's no longer the internet and when something else has come along.
Right. So, anyway, that we managed to fill the full hour, and it wasn't total crap. sometimes it's difficult to find if something majorly crazy has happened or hasn't happened. It can be a little difficult to find.
We're in the summer doldrums. Yeah, that's just the way it is.
It's nerddom and sports. There's not a whole lot to talk about as far as sports are concerned either. But this isn't a sports podcast because there are lots of those. Anyway. As always, our music is out prop featuring Esset. Check them out on uhort.no. Check us out on Twitter. We are at GIR Podcast. Again, if you have a Chromecast or anything like that, shoot us an email. I would really dig taking a look at it and seeing your personal review. You can also shoot us an email, as I said, to girpodcast@gmail.com. For Russell, this is Jeremy. Thanks for listening.
Dongle.